You are listening to a free podcast of The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. To support the show and receive nearly an hour extra material daily, become a member today at majority.fm. Resistance is futile.
It's Sam Cedar, launching an illegal invasion and occupation of your brain.
This episode of The Majority Report is brought to you by Audible.com. You can get a free audiobook of your choice. Go to audiblepodcast.com/majority report. That's audiblepodcast.com/majority report for a free audiobook.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. It's time to look in the mirror, America. Do you like what you see?
I keep referring to Obama as the magic Negro.
Do you like what you see now?
Well, suck on this.
It's just a mirror, America.
Shared sacrifice by everybody.
What could it do to you except reflect your image?
I did nothing wrong at the Minneapolis airport.
The Majority Report.
Far more credible to me than PBS
and Frontline.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
And I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Tuesday, March 5th, 2013. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Today on the program, he who makes the rules. Piece by Haley Sweetland Edwards. Just how corporations, right-wing judges, and Republican Congress people destroy our regulatory system. Also on the program today, sequester hits the FBI. We joked about it yesterday, but now they're saying they're not going to be able to prosecute Wall Street, presumably at the levels that they were doing before. Jeb Bush starting his campaign for 2016, already having to pivot. And the Daily Caller, just the latest example of the fraud that is right-wing media. Not to mention that story that we had, well, we'll get to it today, about the other fraud that is the right-wing media. All that and more on today's program. This is a lovely little story. One that should start your day off well. Via Feministing and Life, Inc. Apparently, the San Diego Christian College last October brought one of their employees, Terry James, into her office. And she was asked, "Are you pregnant?" And apparently, James was indeed pregnant. She was unmarried. Therefore, the college concluded that she had violated school rules as an employee, i.e. that she had had premarital sex. She apparently had signed a community covenant that said that she would not engage in premarital sex. And while the covenant did not say that the punishment for premarital sex would be firing from her job, she was fired on the spot for engaging in premarital sex. She is now suing the school because the covenant never outlined the fact that she would be fired. One of the things that has come up in this lawsuit is that her job after she was fired was offered to her then fiance, now husband, who presumably also engaged in premarital sex, thereby getting her pregnant. But apparently, in this at the San Diego Christian College, we need to see the proof in the form of pregnancy to determine whether or not you had premarital sex. Just a wonderful little story of a Christian college and their covenant. The suit is gone to trial now, and not sure exactly what Terry James is seeking from them, but just a wonderful little story about how the Christian right, you know, premarital sex only happens with women. It apparently does not happen with men, because how could you prove it? I don't even know what to make of that. All right, we're going to take a break. Just figured something a little bit light, because this next story is a little bit weedy and a little bit disturbing, but very, very important for you to understand how things like the Dodd-Frank law, which started off as a compromise, gets even more compromised as the process continues on. We're going to take a break. We'll be right back with Haley Sweetland Edwards. This episode of the Majority Report is brought to you by Audible.com, the internet's leading provider of audiobooks, with more than 100,000 downloadable titles across all types of literature, featuring audio versions of many New York Times bestsellers. For our listeners, Audible is offering a free audiobook. To get it, go to audiblepodcast.com/majority report. Why not get, in light of our talk about Dodd-Frank today, The Big Short, Inside the Doomsday Machine by Michael Lewis. Get it for free right now at audiblepodcast.com/majority report. Do it! We are back. Sam Cedar on the Majority Report on the phone. Haley Sweetland Edwards, she is an editor at the Washington Monthly. She has a piece out in the March-April edition of the Washington Monthly, He Who Makes the Rules. Haley, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
I got to tell you, to start off, the your piece is wonderfully written. It is so essential, I think, that people understand exactly how the rubber meets the road, I guess, in the in our regulatory process. It's not pretty, but let's start. And your piece focuses primarily on Dodd-Frank and how it goes from being a law to being implemented, or how it doesn't go from being a law, or I should say, how it goes from being a law to not necessarily being implemented. But it's instructive about rulemaking in general. But start with the story that you tell up front about the U.S. Commodity Futures Trading Commission and one of its Democratic commissioners, Bart Chilton.
Well, thank you so much, Sam, for your kind words, first of all. it is a really important story. It's something I didn't realize was as important until I started reporting it. And as you said, this big legislation like Dodd-Frank and Obamacare, you know, they pass, but they don't really mean anything until their rules are written, until the regulations come out of the agencies. So that's really a crucial part of it. And that story you mentioned, in 2010, one of the commissioners at the CFTC, Bart Chilton, walked into a meeting in with one of the largest commodities exchanges in the country, and it was to discuss, among other things, this rule on position limits. And he, it says very explicitly in Dodd-Frank.
Well, tell us just, explain to us just, for those of us, for whom this stuff is a little bit, arcane, what are position limits?
Sure. Yeah. Position limits, put a cap essentially on the amount, on the number of derivatives that can be traded on a certain commodity, like coffee or gas or oil or something like that. That basically, so by having a position limit on there, it limits the amount that some big institution like JP Morgan Chase or Goldman Sachs can trade and therefore corner a market and drive and manipulate prices, drive up or down prices.
This has been a huge issue with things like food and oil in particular, because we have basically, when we have a trading of commodities, initially the idea behind trading commodities like this was to provide some type of consistency of price, and so that if a farmer was going to take stuff to market, they would know more or less what they were going to get, and so they could actually plan out. And unfortunately, so much of it has been taken over by speculators that it is creating, I guess, unnatural price points for these commodities.
Exactly. So that, and you're absolutely right. I mean, they make sense in some realms. If you're a farmer, you know, you need to know how much you can, you need to peg your cattle to a certain price and still be able to buy them the feed they need. But it makes less sense when you have these enormous institutions in our modern world manipulating the prices of commodities like oil, which we see at our gas stations. You know, we're paying more per gallon of gas than we probably should be paying. And all this gets very controversial, but I think that much is fairly clear.
Okay, so he walks into this this meeting ostensibly to get feedback and to work out sort of the scope of position limits.
Exactly, and he goes in very diplomatically. He says to this to the very top brass of this commodities exchange, basically, how can we make a rule that works with you, and how can we work with you? We have to establish this rule. It's the government's will. It says so in Dodd-Frank, but we want to establish this rule in a way that it will be easier to comply with for you. He basically goes in, laying down his cards and saying, you know, how can we help you in establishing this rule? And they respond by saying, what? You have to establish position limits? Because in the line in Dodd-Frank, it says the commission shall establish position limits as appropriate. And later on, everyone says, of course, that as appropriate means that the level of the position limits should be appropriate to the commodity. But the lawyers at this exchange actually take those two little words, as appropriate, to mean that the commission shall establish limits. Should, you know, whether or not they establish them is up to their discretion, which is obviously a very clever and very manipulative way to interpret that law.
Now, this is fascinating.
The kind of thing we see.
Let me just read the actual text. It's the commission shall by rule, regulation, or order establish limits on the amount of positions as appropriate, and the argument that the lawyers are making is that the words as appropriate modify the commission shall by rule or regulation or order establish limits, whereas the intent of that sentence was that as appropriate was to modify the words amount of positions.
Exactly. They're saying it's modifying the verb when it really obviously modifies levels. And to the point where that exact phrase has appeared in other statutes, going back at least to the 70s, if not before. The CFTC actually has position limits on grain, and they use that exact same line to establish their authority to establish those limits. So it really is a sleight of hand more than a legitimate legal interpretation of that line.
But, however, this sleight of hand has huge implications. Tell us about what happened.
Exactly. After the CFTC issued this final rule establishing position limits on, I believe it was 28 different commodities, about a month or two later, very shortly after, two of the biggest speculators in the country sued the CFTC and said on those grounds, they said that the two things, that the commission had not done an adequate cost-benefit analysis report on the impact of its rule, and second, that it had, that those two words, as appropriate, made it so that the CFTC had to demonstrate that it was indeed appropriate for them to establish these limits. And the suit went to the U.S. District Court, where it was decided in favor of the speculators, and the rule was thrown out. It's dead.
And we should say that the lawyer for the plaintiffs in this case was Eugene Scalia, whose name should be familiar to those people, being the son of Justice Antonin Scalia, and so this is now we're talking about an extended process, a law that was written now two years earlier, and the CTFC basically held off on their voting for this because they wanted to get it right. They went through this entire process and then ultimately were sued. It was overturned. And tell us just a little bit about, this is the U.S. District Court of Columbia, which is a, tell us about the makeup of that court.
Well, the real problem here, the court that actually has the most authority is one step above that court. And it's the U.S. District, it's the D.C. Court of Appeals. For the D.C. Circuit, and that is a court that it's eight of the judges were appointed by Republicans, and not only that, but very, very activist Republicans, those who were following the overturn of the vacation appointments, the recess appointments in January, will be familiar with some of these judges. Actions that they're really just activist conservatives who are interpreting these statutes in any way they see fit. But it's the highest court in the nation for regulatory affairs. I mean, it's really the second most powerful court in the land. And things do get kicked up to Supreme Court, so I guess that's not totally true. But it's the most powerful, pretty much the most powerful court when it comes to deciding what rules and regulations come out of the agencies and stand, and which don't. And as of now, they're dominated by Judge Ginsburg and Judge Fentel and these sort of overwhelmingly conservative activist judges who have made a habit of overturning Dodd-Frank rules. There have been three that they've overturned in that process, in addition to dozens of other rules over the last decade or so.
One of them is Janice Rogers Brown, right? Who I think has been on record saying that this country went socialist after Social Security was established, or the New Deal.
That's right.
And I mean, just to give folks a sense of who is sort of essentially adjudicating this process, and just sort of the notion, just to stay on that part before we broaden this out a little bit, the idea of that the CTFC had to, the CFTC rather had to establish the notion that their regulating this was appropriate almost sort of begs the question, because the fact that Congress had made that decision to empower them to do so it sort of seems to me to be prima facie evidence that it's appropriate. I mean, how does one prove that it is appropriate to do this beyond what Congress has deemed to be appropriate?
Right. I mean, you get into these questions, and it gets even more complicated with these very complex laws like Dodd-Frank that are dealing in very complex realms like financial reform. A lot of the law is written, a lot of Dodd-Frank is written very ambiguously. A lot of the verbiage is vague precisely because it's not Congress's job. They don't have the technical experience to actually know how the derivatives market should be regulated, say, or how position limits should be implemented. So a lot of that discretion of how a rule or regulation is implemented is left up to the agencies. And to these rulemakers who are teams of people who have an extraordinary amount of expertise in their world. And that's one thing. I mean, you have these, I think we all kind of imagine, when we imagine rulemakers at all, which isn't often, we imagine them to be sort of bureaucrats sitting in their cubicles. But in all of my experiences in reporting these stories, interacting with these rulemakers, particularly at the CFTC and things, they're overwhelmingly informed. They're very intelligent. They really know what's going on, but they're facing this daunting gauntlet of information to actually implement the rule as they know, as they see fit, and as the law determines that they should.
And you outlined essentially three main areas of that gauntlet. The first is the agency itself. The second is in court, and the third is in Congress, and to a certain extent, at least two of those sort of areas or this two aspects of that gauntlet are expressed in that story. But tell us first about the rulemaking process. What is the sort of the governing statute for that rulemaking process, and how the agencies themselves are the actual, I guess, creation of the rule, how it is subject to being thwarted by interests who would otherwise be regulated by that rule?
Well, it's the entire rulemaking process is overseen primarily by the Administrative Procedure Act and the APA, and that is that forget exactly when it was passed, but I believe the 1940s, and it was immediately sort of following the New Deal era, this expansion of agencies in the federal government. And it's and so it lays out the framework of how Congress passes a law. It's passed off to the agency or series of agencies that will then implement it. Someone actually goes through and figures out which of the lines in the law requires a study, which of the lines requires immediate action, which of the lines gives the agencies discretion to act, should they deem that appropriate. And so it shunts off a lot of that responsibility for the actual nitty-gritty lawmaking to the agencies and to the rulemakers themselves. And these are these groups of economists and analysts and lawyers who actually sit down with this material and attempt to write the rules out of it. One major challenge there is that is obviously in this process in the notice of proposed rulemaking, which of course this is the federal government, so that has an acronym too. But during that process, it's a big fact gathering period where these rulemakers go out and they try to figure out everything they can about a certain industry and a certain world within that industry and try to figure out the best way to regulate it, essentially, in following the advice of the rule itself, which is what they have to do. That's the law of the land. But during that time, one of the primary obstacles that they're facing is that a huge number of the studies, if not all of them, coming out of the industry are funded by industry itself or funded by industry, by industry lobbyists, or industry trade groups that are the ones that, frankly, have access to the information about how the bottom line works. And they also have a very explicit interest in keeping the regulators from actually putting any real burden on the industry. And so you kind of have this asymmetry of information that is very real, and rulemakers have to struggle with that. The other part of that process is that during that time, throughout the rulemaking process, before they issue a proposed rule and a final rule, rulemakers are always meeting with people from the public, basically. But most of the time, it's industry. As Commissioner Bart Chilton, the one we were talking about from the CFTC before, he estimated that of every 100 meetings that he has, one of them is with a reform group, a citizens group. 99 of them are with industry analysts and people who from, say, J.P. Morgan Chase or Goldman Sachs or these major financial institutions that have an interest in basically feeding rulemakers information that will behoove them.
Now, we should say that in the case of particularly, I mean, I think I would imagine that particularly when it comes to regulations on our financial system, that disparity is at its greatest. I mean, as opposed to, say, the Affordable Care Act, because there seems to be, just from my own experience, far more advocacy for health reform than there is for financial reform. And so but I would imagine that there's still a disparity in terms of industry versus reform. And this isn't to say that those regulators are necessarily corrupt necessarily. I mean, the revolving door is another issue, but you've outlined two aspects of this that are difficult. One is in the context of the CTFC or other financial regulations, you have such asymmetry of information. It's not just that this makes it hard for the rulemakers to do their job, because they probably are aware that the information they're getting is tainted by its source on some level. But it's also they have to worry about this because this is what could be. I mean, this is essentially they have a sense of what discovery is going to be if they are sued. Right. I mean, that when these are the initial claims by an industry that can undercut the legal status of the law if this industry decides to take them to court.
Right. Exactly. Exactly. And that's the problem that we were talking about before, where this all ties in together, all three stages of those gauntlets, all three stages of the gauntlet, rather. If there are lots of ways that industry can sue an agency, and one is by saying that they didn't take into account X study that was done. So another thing I write about in this article is the Securities and Exchange Commission's rule on proxy access, which would allow stockholders to vote on the makeup of a corporate board, and that's one of the ways that you can put that stockholders could put the brakes on corporate pay. That's the reason why it's important. And repeatedly, the SEC has had this power to establish this proxy access rule. And repeatedly, it has not been able to do so. Dodd-Frank, essentially, the way Dodd-Frank was written, it essentially reminded the SEC and nudged it and said, hey, by the way, you have the power to implement a proxy access rule. Why don't you go ahead and do that? So emboldened by that, it established another proxy access, or wrote the final rule for another proxy access rule, which was overturned by the D.C. District Court of Appeals.
This was Business Roundtable versus the SEC, and this was a crucial. This just happened, I guess, a year or two ago. I remember we talked about it quite a bit on this program, because one of the real issues that we have in this day is that you have a board of directors who basically or a CEO who picks their board of directors. It's so incestuous incestuous, they end up in many respects almost double dealing and creating compensation packages for themselves that are sometimes at odds with what shareholders would want for their long-term for the long-term goals of a corporation. And this was an attempt by outside shareholders to say, we have a right of putting up our own slate of candidates instead of letting this process be dominated by the same group of people so that they could deal to themselves. And this was a rule that ended up getting overturned. So tell us how that happened as well.
Exactly. And that's a much better description of the proxy access rule. Thank you. One of the reason why I bring up that case in particular is because it illustrates the ways in which industry can use its power to overturn these rules based on essentially minutia, essentially twisting the language of a law and the ways that it's being interpreted, that it has been interpreted over the last few years by a very, very conservative court. In the proxy access rule, they attack our Business Roundtable and the Chamber of Commerce attacked it on the grounds that the SEC had not adequately done a cost-benefit analysis report. And that makes perfect sense from a sort of commonsensical standpoint. You say, oh, yeah, well, you know, before implementing a rule, let's measure the costs and let's measure the benefits. That seems to make sense. That's maybe the way that I operate in my daily life. I'm not going to go out and, I don't know, get a gym membership without thinking about the cost of that on my budget and the cost of that on my lifestyle and the benefits to my lifestyle, rather. And it just loses all rationality when it hits the court. And that's the major thing to remember here, is that conservatives are using cost-benefit analysis as a way to overturn whatever rule they want. And that is why Roundtable versus the SEC was such a shot across the bow, because it essentially took this rule that the SEC has complete power to implement and that Dodd-Frank explicitly reminded the SEC to implement, and then these two very, very powerful industry organizations were able to go into the cost-benefit analysis and say, you didn't consider this one report that we submitted that would say that this proxy access rule would have an enormous impact on industry. And what the judges failed to note there is that report itself had been funded by industry. So you kind of get into this feedback loop where it becomes the absolute absurd, almost on an existential level.
Now, people should understand here that very generally and quickly about the sort of the ambiguity of a cost-benefit analysis of a rule like this, is because to whom are we calculating the cost? To whom are we calculating the benefit? It's completely vague. And of course, the report that you get from the industry is going to reflect exactly their perspective of the cost. They diminish the nature of the benefit. We could argue that there's a benefit, society wide, but it is a very difficult thing to analyze. And the fact that the court would look at just simply a report about the cost benefit analysis, which is contrary to making this rule, means that those rulemakers going back in time or in the future are going to have to look at a report that is issued by industry in that instance and say, this could sink the entire rule if we get to court, which they will necessarily take us to court. And so we have to deal with this in some fashion. And it's almost impossible to deal with because we don't either A, have the resources to refute it, Or B, the terms of which the notion of cost benefit analysis are so vague that we can't possibly guess what a court is going to set up as parameters. Because when I go to join a gym, I know I'm just talking about my health and my checkbook. It's a fairly simple thing to do, but in the context of this case, the factors are almost infinite.
Exactly, exactly. And you hit the nail on the head there, that it's any report that comes out of industry is going to be biased towards industry. We can accept that. And that's fine. In fact, you know, that's part of the democratic process, that everyone is going to be speaking for their own self-interest. But it has to come down. We have to be able to defer to agencies to be able to make those decisions and say, well, this report is clearly biased. And based on this other number of reports, these half dozen of reports and interviews with experts, we believe this industry report to be hyperbolic or to be based entirely untrue. But the point is that discretion has to end with the regulators themselves. It has to end with the rulemakers. And right now, it's not. Right now, it's ending with the judges.
And in fact,
Not only is it
ending with the judges, but in fact, they don't necessarily even when they ruled in this way in Business Roundtable versus SEC, they didn't even rule on the specifics of the cost benefit analysis. They simply said because there is a report that says there's too much cost versus the benefit, that negates the whole process, right? I mean, they didn't even get into the granular parts of what they just said. The mere existence of it is enough to sink the rule.
And that's not – and the this is all fairly new, too. In the early – there's the famous case from Chevron from 1984 says specifically that the courts must defer to the agency's technical experience, to the rulemakers' experience in general, and specifically in their experience of these technical issues. And Business versus Roundtable essentially throws that precedent, that extremely important precedent, out the window.
All right. So those are the first two aspects of the gauntlet, and they are interrelated, as people can see, because you become very gun-shy as a regulator if you know that 2 years down the road, after all this work, it can be sunk by the mere existence of a report by one of the interested parties that sort of says, like, this is a bad idea. The third part, the stage three, is Congress retroactively attacking the law that they have already passed.
Exactly. And that's this is the part that I think people tend to think, or at least I did, you know, that Congress passes a law. It's such a battle to get a law passed these days. And then finally it's passed. It's as strong as it is. It's got its weaknesses. There are a couple news stories, and that's it. Congress wipes its hands of it, and it's shunted off to the agencies to be made into rules and regulations. And what I found over the course of this reporting is that is basically just not where it ends. From there, after a rule has been passed, and after it has been shunted off to the agencies, these lawmakers, and often conservatives and Republicans who have a natural sort of anti-regulation bias, can go in and weaken these rules in any number of ways. And one way is by passing a what's called a technical amendment. And it often looks very very innocuous on paper. They're very technically written. It says, you know, in section 8 of subsection 9, you know, it's just one very small part of it. And oftentimes rulemakers won't even really pay attention to these amendments, but they have the effect of gutting entire sections of a bill after it has already been passed.
And then there's also they use these technical amendments, and then they use sort of blunter instruments as well. In terms of funding of agencies that are supposed to take out these that are supposed to execute these rules, they do it also. I mean, in terms of like the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, it's almost outright nullification in some respects. Just walk us through those two aspects.
Right. Yeah. The funding streams are, I mean, it's just extremely manipulative. The appropriations process, Congress holds the purse strings of a lot of these agencies, and the SEC, for example, and the CFTC, which we were talking about before. They determine how much staff, essentially, these agencies are going to have, what their budgets are. And at a time when they're making these increasingly difficult demands of agencies, making them submit incredibly, arguably, impossibly stringent cost-benefit analyses, they're not expanding their budgets. They're, in fact, contracting them while giving them more and more responsibility. So just these simple appropriations methods are just really, really insidious. With the CFPB, that was actually designed, and it's one of the coups of its design, that it does not fall under the congressional appropriations. It is it has an independent funding source, and therefore has the ability to act in ways that maybe the Republicans and conservatives in Congress would like to go back and quote unquote punish it, but they can't.
That revenue source that revenue source is a tax on banks that gets paid essentially that provides their funding. So it is not subject to Congress saying we're going to cut your funding because it's not coming from the general fund.
Exactly, it's a fee-based source, and one of the sort of more insidious things about the overturn of those Obama's recess appointments in January was that it that now in order to reappoint the head Richard Cordray or appoint another head, one of the things that the Republicans are holding over their heads is they're saying, okay, we'll appoint another director to this agency if you put it under the umbrella of congressional appropriations, and therefore subject it to these purse strings, to the ability of Congress to manipulate their purse strings.
This is so stunning. So I really hope that people understand the dynamic here. The ruling about the National Labor Relations Board's recess appointees happened, I guess, a couple months ago. And essentially now the president has very little, or at least there is, we don't know for sure, but it appears that the president has very little room to provide recess appointments. Cordray is being held essentially hostage, or the position is being held hostage, so that Congress has the ability to get a hold of the funding stream of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, set up specifically not to have that dynamic, so that they can then, presumably in the future, cut the funding for this organization and make it anemic. So it's a really a stunning power play and very explicit in what they're doing. That's why I call it nullification, because they're essentially trying to destroy the law that set up this bureau in the first place. So we have outlined the horridness and the difficulty in getting these laws passed. I think only one-third of Dodd-Frank's laws or rules, I should say, are in effect as projected from the law that was passed almost 3 years ago now. You outline three different sort of prescriptions for improving this process. Just walk us through them quickly.
Well, unfortunately, I don't have it in front of me, so I'm not sure.
Well, you talk about the White House has to get more involved in this. It starts it off. The president obviously has to go back in and continue to fight this fight. I mean, this is the difficulty of this, is because you're right. As soon as we pass a law, everybody's sort of exhausted. The media appetite for it goes away, and then it enters into this sort of very dark, it heads to the basement, essentially. There's very little sunlight. There's a lot of moisture, and all sorts of horrible things start to grow.
Exactly. It becomes a whole shadow fight where the rules get a little hazier and people start, picking up folded chairs and just whacking each other over the head with them. It becomes really ugly really quickly. One way that we can help combat that, which I talk about in the solutions part of the piece, is to help equal the playing field in terms of the asymmetry of information. We talked before about industry having an overwhelming monopoly on the number of reports, the amount of information that rulemakers are getting when they are set out to write a rule. One way that we can combat that, it's actually built into Dodd-Frank itself. There's the Office of Financial Research, the OFR, I believe. And that just got a new head that finally, after 2 years or after at least 10 months, we managed to finally appoint a head to that. And now it has the potential to be a very powerful organization that could require industry to give them certain information. They can share that with the different agencies, and it could be a powerful source of information. It's something that right now reformers don't have a whole lot of hope for. The board is overwhelmingly dominated by corporate interests, and the Republicans in Congress have made several efforts to kill it entirely. Claiming that it is just no good for the corporate sector. So there's a hope. Some people are putting their eggs in that basket. Some people are saying that's probably not going to help. Right now we have these very small shops. We have, Public Citizen and Better Markets and, these certain consumer groups around town that are really kind of running a David and Goliath show of trying to marshal as much information as they can and submit these informed public comment letters and submit reports that combat what industry is saying. But right now we need just a lot more of that. We need public scrutiny. We need people who know what they're talking about in this field to be writing public comments to the regulators themselves and giving them the public's perspective.
It's fascinating to compare and contrast Dodd-Frank with the Affordable Care Act, because there just seems to be so many more resources for reform-minded people in terms of healthcare than financial regulation. I mean, I head down to Families USA and I talk to literally dozens of people who are working on different aspects of the Affordable Care Act, who have who are immersed in the healthcare providing industry in one fashion or another. And so there seems to be a lot more scrutiny of the rulemaking process. There's the outcomes, I presume, are somewhat better, because the Affordable Care Act is another one of those things where so much is left up to the agencies to implement, both on a federal level and on a state level. Whereas in the financial world, you're right, you got Dennis Kelleher, who I should say is another Worcester boy, and I've spoken to him in the past, but he is completely underfunded. I mean, he's literally, I think I could name the three people who are actually going into these offices. I think there's also the IPAB, which is essentially a lot of tort lawyers who go in and represent people who have large institutional cases against these big financial companies. But there just isn't the same amount of firepower to scrutinize the rulemaking process and to support the rulemakers who, as far as I can tell, and you tell me from your reporting, seem to be, in general, seem to be people who have a genuine interest and have a tremendous amount of integrity one wanting to implement this, but they just are boxed in by too many avenues.
That's absolutely true. I mean, so you mentioned Dennis Kelleher at Better Markets, and his annual budget is, he told me, $2 million, which, to give you an idea, is how much industry spends on lobbyists every day and a half. And that's lobbyists alone. That's not including trade groups. That's not including their underfunded think tanks and things like the Business Roundtable and things like that. I mean, it's just overwhelming. They spend, I think according to public records, it's $1.4 million per day on lobbyists alone. So to say that they're outgunned is just an enormous overstatement. I think that you also make a good point there, that the rulemakers, the regulators, they are often choosing to take this to to take these positions at the CFTC, at the SEC. They have this, there's a certain, they're there because they have an interest in being on the public policy stage. They want to do, they want to regulate often. They want to do the right thing. They don't want to harm the economy, but they do want to protect consumers, and they want to protect us from having another financial crisis. Honestly, that's the most important thing to the half dozen of these real live rulemakers who I spoke to,
right,
both on and off the record.
I think it's,
and I
think it's easy for people to get cynical about the revolving door. But I think you know the big pressure points, it seems to me, seem to be the courts. And I think people who are interested in some equity and in making sure that we are policing in some fashion this financial industry, which sunk our economy and has created all sorts of suffering, really need to start to focus on the implications, particularly of the courts, because if the courts are more amenable to some type of regulatory regime, that is going to empower the regulators, and it's also going to inhibit what Congress thinks that they can do as well.
Exactly, and we on that district circuit court of appeals that we were talking about before, there are vacancies there right now. There are 3 vacancies. There have been for quite some time. And we need to be filling those. We need to rebalance that court. And also, you really can't underestimate the power of public scrutiny on this, of sunlight, as you said before.
Well, Haley Sweetland Edwards, the piece is He Who Makes the Rules. We have a link to this at majority.fm. Folks, this is I want to just tell you, Haley, again, that I think the piece is incredibly well written. It is very weedy stuff, but you make it very easy to follow and digest. And I think it's really important if we want to have a sense of why we see a failure, that we need to move past sort of some of the easy answers and understand how complex this is, so that we can marshal our resources into areas that will be really effective, because we're clearly outmatched here in terms of those resources. So we must expend them wisely. Haley, thanks again for your piece.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me on.
All right, folks. Wow. Oh, we went a little further. You get into this stuff. It's just, it's fascinating. And this was really an eye-opening piece, in many respects, because it's very easy simply to talk about the regulatory capture. But what we have here is, a far greater and more nuanced problem, than what we see regulatory capture. It is broad theories cannot cover this. But I do think that it's quite clear that the linchpin for this stuff are the federal courts. I mean, that is where that is what ultimately empowers or disempowers our regulators. And if courts are amenable to regulation, if they're not amenable to regulation, everything else falls apart. That's just the bottom line. And when you have the nut jobs that we have on these D.C. District Court, who think that the Circuit Court, who literally go out and say that we have turned into a socialist country after the New Deal, then you know we've got a major problem. All right, folks. once again, look at what's happened to my voice. Look at what I do for you people. Look at how I strain my vocal cords for you. Folks, the prices of lozenges have skyrocketed because of the tremendous commodity manipulation and speculation in the lozenge market. And, of course, now we see why the Commodities Future Trading regulatory agencies can't keep the speculators out of the coffee lozenge business. Therefore, making it that much more expensive to buy lozenges. So you need to do 2 things. 1, you need to read this piece and educate yourself about these things. And 2, become a member of the Majority Report, so that I can fight this speculation in the lozenge market. You can join today. It's pennies a day, a quarter and a nickel a day. But you will ensure that this show sticks around and you will get more and more interviews like this that will hopefully illuminate and not too depress. Depressitate. All right, folks, we're going to head into the better half of the program. I am firing up the IM machine, tardy, but just in time, better late than never. You can IM me at Majority FM. You can call the program, 646-257-3920. Are you a libertarian who wants to explain to me why we should have less government? Because that's better in some way. You want to comment on the debate that I had with Jonathan Alter yesterday? Feel free. You want to talk about how President Obama still desperately clinging to this idea that he can create entitlement reform and cement his legacy? You want to just weigh in on the fact that Theo has made a late surge in the naming sweeps of my child?
Dangerous.
Anything else you want to talk about? The number 646-257-3920, 646-257-3920. Again, the conservative lines completely open at 646-257-3920. We haven't heard from a libertarian in a while. And, you know, weirdly, we just don't hear that much from straight-on conservatives. They must be very quiet. Do you think Jeb Bush will be our next president? Please call in. Did you enjoy his twisting and turning over the past couple days? I have not seen the Krugman-Scarborough so-called debate. Oh, and let me also add this. Happy birthday to my sister, Julie. Happy birthday, Julie. All right. See you in the better half.